Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today, it's episode 160. I'm joined by Dr. Jay Stewart of the University of California, San Francisco. Yes, this is a double J episode. We discuss costs of vitrectomy versus scleral buckling, outcomes of resident fellow performed surgeries in ophthalmology, and also his experience using the Retisert implant. A list of financial disclosures are attached to this episode in the episode description. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now honored to be joined by Dr. Jay Stewart. Dr. Stewart is Chief of Ophthalmology at San Francisco General Hospital, as well as Professor of Ophthalmology at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Stewart, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We start every episode with a new guest with the same question. It gets old, but it always is interesting and new because everyone has a different story. So what's your story? How did you become an ophthalmologist and then a retina specialist?
Yeah, so I kind of first got introduced in ophthalmology during medical school, and I think it's something that's familiar to a lot of us. I was really attracted by the mixture of surgical and medical treatment, and at that time I didn't quite realize how much fun it would be to play with the new technology that we have in ophthalmology as well. And so, I got into ophthalmology, and then really through exposure to some very influential mentors, including Dr. Dan Schwartz at UCSF, I was fascinated by retina and just had to be part of retina. So that's how I got into this field.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so, I think the reason that retina in particular was so attractive to me was just for what a lot of us have seen, which is being able to manage complications in the eye from front to back. And I was very fortunate to be, have excellent training in throughout the areas of ophthalmology at UCSF. And then I went to Doheny, which really gave me exposure to lots of areas of retina. And I think that, I didn't even appreciate at the time how broad the opportunities within retina are to be educated and trained. And so, having the opportunity to work with, pediatric retina and treatment of ROP, adult, we had the opportunity to work in a county hospital in LA. And so we had tons of patients with diabetic retinopathy, which was really excellent learning. And then the other thing I think about training, which probably come up later in our talk, is the role of scleral buckle surgery in particular, which around that time was starting to become a little less done, I think. And but having had the opportunity to get a good amount of exposure to different scleral buckle techniques, which has really come in handy quite a bit, since that time. And I really think it's important for us to work hard to keep that alive in fellowship training.
Well, and teaching is definitely based on your experience at UCSF as well as your publication history. I mean, you published extensively on teaching and kind of the experiences of resident fellow performed surgery. We'll talk a little bit about that a little later. But let's dive into the buckle topic, because one of the articles you did publish was looking at costs of buckling versus vitrectomy. It was an interesting cost analysis because it wasn't just like, okay, a buckle costs this much and a vitrectomy costs this much. It was actually, breaking it down in terms of outcomes and what it means for the system as a whole. And the results were a little different depending on the phakic status of a patient. So what did you guys find in that study, and did it surprise you? And how do you kind of incorporate that into your practice?
Yeah, so that was a great study. It was a lot of fun to work together with Mike Cedar when he was a resident. He went on to do retina training at Duke after that. And we basically were trying to do a cost comparison, really trying to say if a patient comes in the door and they really could get either a scleral buckle or a vitrectomy for the same type of retinal detachment, what would the cost difference be? And so to do that, we actually based our study on the only published randomized study that included both buccal and vitrectomy and phakic and pseudophakic patients, which was the SPR study, which was a large study done in Europe, the scleral bucking versus primary vitrectomy study. And basically, using the numbers from that study, we then tried to assign average costs that it would take to essentially follow the patient through the process. And so That study broke it down into phagic and pseudophagic groups. And so within each group, the phagic group had some patients that got sclerobuccal and some that got vitrectomy, and the same for pseudophagic group. And what it comes down to is that there is an initial sort of baseline cost that you would think of if you were to look it up. There's a surgeon fee and there's an ASC fee. There's an anesthesia fee. And so there's sort of a total Medicare cost that goes with doing a sclerobuccal or that goes with a vitrectomy. And, you know, this was done in 2013, but the sclerobuccal in some of that would be cheaper on average. But what happens is that when you take a patient through the whole process, and that's what the study kind of does, you know, there's imperfections. There's what they termed retina affecting procedures or secondary procedures that needed to be done in order to bring the patients to, you know, a successful treatment. And so factoring those costs in, you also have to factor in the cost of cataract surgery that would need to be done for patients who develop that. And so when you kind of sum it up, what we found was that in the phagic group, the actual cost for overall cost on average for having a retinal detachment repair was actually less in the sclerobuccal group. On the other hand, in the pseudophagic group, the vitrectomy approach was actually less expensive. And the differences were not great, but one of the things that we figured out was that the costs were largely driven by what happened after the initial surgery. So, you know, how successful are you at getting the retina reattached with one procedure? And those secondary procedures, the return to the operating room, the office gas injections and lasers, those things actually add up as well. And in the same way, you know, the cataract surgery portion of it, you know, does tend to add up as for patients who are phagic and then develop a cataract. And so that's where you have to take those things into account. And so the sort of one-line summary of the study was that buccals were cheaper for phagic patients and vitrectomies were cheaper for pseudophagic patients. But I think that, you know, you have to sort of take the reality approach, which is what are you good at as a surgeon and what is your system, you know, optimized for in terms of efficiency. And so I think if you're working in a situation where you've got an efficient workflow and, you know, you're very, very comfortable doing vitrectomy, let's say, it may be that you can knock out that phagic retinal detachment even with a vitrectomy in a very small amount of time with local anesthesia and, you know, without having a high secondary procedure rate. And that may actually turn out to be less expensive in a way than if you do buccals less frequently. But then you have to do a lot of secondary procedures to kind of fix them afterwards. And so it's a little bit hard to draw an average there, but I think that the general principle is that it makes sense to think about cost as one of the things that you take into account when sort of at a societal level, but on an individual level, it may be a little bit harder just because, you know, people's skills vary. And that's what I was getting at before. I think sclerobuccaling is the right procedure, certainly for some patients who are phagic, perhaps with no PVD, a young myopic patient with, you know, peripheral atrophic holes. And so you want to be able to offer that patient a buccal and have it be successful and not require a lot of these secondary procedures. And so that's where I think training and fellowship is so important.
Well, and let's dive into that a little bit. I don't want to beat a dead horse to death because we talk about this a lot. It was a very pro buccal podcast and a lot of our guests are pro buccal, but let's talk about, you know, I always ask, you know, because some training programs emphasize buccals and some places don't expose their fellows to as many buccals. Let's talk about, I think buccals are the most challenging isn't the technical parts of doing it, much like many parts of surgery. It's the conceptual part of it that makes people who have done less and when you first started doing it on their own a little more uncomfortable. You know, what do you try to teach your fellows in terms of the different concepts between a buccal and a vitrectomy in terms of subretinal fluid, in terms of when do you drain versus when do you use gas versus when do you do both? I mean, these are the things that I think drive people a little crazy when they're first learning how to do it, the decision tree versus just doing a vitrectomy, making a retinotomy, and then putting gas. What do you kind of try to emphasize to your fellows when you're teaching them?
I think you're right. I think there's a lot of variability in how you can do buccals, and it can be bewildering in a way to sort of figure out what does that mean to offer a buccal to a patient when you see different, you know, physicians approaching it different ways? And as you say, doing a vitrectomy is more sort of cookie cutter in some ways. And so I try to really take a look at the extent of the detachment and narrow it down that way. And I actually favor doing segmental buckles quite a bit when indicated, only because it shortens the procedure, it minimizes the area of dissection on the eye. And so, you know, we tend to have a lot of patients who are falling into the category of a young patient with an asymptomatic or semi-asymptomatic inferior detachment, you know, coming up into the macula or involving the macula now. And, you know, those patients, I think that I've had a lot of success coaching the fellows and even residents into viewing those patients as someone who is a very good candidate for a pretty quick procedure in a way, with limited area of dissection inferiorly and you know, running the segmental from, you know, 4 to 8 o'clock or something like that. And so we have gotten that workflow pretty pretty smoothly paved. And so we envision that that's what we're going to do, I think, when we see those patients. And, you know, you can do that in any clock hour, really, but it oftentimes is the inferior detachments. And, you know, I learned a lot along the way, techniques that I didn't pick up as a fellow. And so, you know, John Kitchens and others have introduced this idea of using the chandelier light for visualization. And that's been tremendously impactful for me. We use that as a matter of routine now. And so every single buckle case that we do, you know, the fellow and the resident are at the microscope and we're all seeing the same thing. And we all can talk about kind of what is the extent of the detachment, how is it that we're choosing to buckle it in this way. And so that's been really, really helpful for us. And in that way, you know, it allows us to look in real time and say, you know, do we think we need to drain this fluid? Look, let's see how the buckle is sitting, how the brakes are sitting on the buckle, and then we can either drain or not under direct visualization with the recite in our case or with the biome. And so, I just think that that's been a really, really helpful advance and something that's been very powerful for education. And it becomes very easy for the fellows to then envision themselves transitioning into an independent role as a scleral buckling surgeon. And so that's why I think that it's been something that we've been able to, I think, inculcate in our fellows, the confidence of being able to take those cases on.
Yeah, I mean, I we've talked about this in other forums. I think chandelier buckling is great. And I think that when people say, the argument people have on the podium is like, well, is it necessary? I think no, I don't think it's necessary to do a buckle. Obviously, you can do a great buckle with an indirect ophthalmoscope. But I think if you're teaching somebody, especially with less buckles being made and with the trainees you're working with much more comfortable with an indirect viewing system than in previous generations, I think that it's almost, it does make some sense. And it is nice to teach someone how to cryo under a chandelier, I think, from letting your heart rate go up too high when they're like, well, I'm not sure what I'm seeing. I can't see my probe, for example. It's nice to be able to see exactly what they're doing in a comfortable environment. I mean, let's talk about resident and fellow surgery a little bit. You've published a lot in this subject in various forms, vitreoretinal surgery, cataract surgery, but let's talk about VR surgery as well. I mean, one of the things you've shown multiple times is that doing these teaching cases, you can have very good outcomes and you know, it can be very safe. In terms of what you try, what have you learned staffing and what kind of things you think are important for teaching fellows when you're staffing a vitrectomy, for example? Again, from a safety perspective, what are the most important things you've learned staffing? What are the things that you've done that you think have helped maintain these good outcomes, even though they're quote-unquote teaching cases?
Yeah, it's a great point. And I think that you're right. We've been able to show that, you know, doing teaching cases doesn't mean you have to compromise patient outcomes or patient safety necessarily. And that's been consistently, we've been able to find that and consistently across different types of procedures. And I really think that, you know, the reason that that's the case is because we do have a culture that we work hard to maintain of, you know, active attending physician engagement in the process. So, you know, it's one thing to do a teaching case where the attending is sort of in the corner reading the newspaper, and it's another one where the attending is at the microscope together, sitting at the side of the fellow, kind of walking and talking through the procedure while the fellow's hands are doing things. And so that's really what we do. And in the same way, we actually have residents involved. And so, you know, at every case we do that would be done this way, we would have the resident actually doing part of the case, oftentimes putting the ports in, for example, or taking down the conjunctiva and muscles. And so, you know, everyone's very engaged, and the attending is engaged at the scope from start to finish. And so I think that's probably the most important feature of how to do this. I do think that, you know, having the visualization kind of to have everyone seeing the same thing, have everyone being able to talk about the features as you go. And I think we're also very open with, you know, our patients. They see the resident, they see the fellow at the pre-op visit or before that even, and then afterwards as well. And so they're part of the care team. And so, you know, it's not surprising to them to hear us talking during the case. And I think that actually smooths out everyone's sort of nerves as well. But I think that above all, the engagement of the faculty member or the supervising attending physician during the case is really successful. And it gives the fellow confidence, and it also makes the fellow feel comfortable to say, okay, you know, can you do this part? And in the same way, the attending physician can be recognizing, you know, what direction this case is going, and they know when it's time to step in.
I mean, and again, I think the thing I struggle with as a staffer, and I think, like, knock on wood, I haven't encountered it yet, is that the hard part is when, if you do have a significant complication when staffing or teaching, you know, how to handle that. That's a difficult conversation. I mean, I think staffing and teaching is one of those things that is interesting, because I think everyone implicitly understands it's necessary at teaching hospitals, and it's necessary for the advancement of the field. If you don't teach people how to do surgery, then, you know, then no one will know how to do surgery in 20 years. But it's just, again, it's really gratifying that you guys have been able to show that. And I think it's, again, super important to show that, because otherwise, if it's a quality of care difference, then it becomes an ethical question. And so if you can show that, but when you do have a complication or do have an issue, I mean, what sort of conversation can be had? I think what you said about maybe having that conversation in advance really helps ease that conversation in the worst case scenario if it has to happen.
Yeah, and I think that, as you say, having the data published, and, you know, is very helpful, because I think people can point to this in pre-op conversations, and they can say, look, you know, this is Dr. X who's going to be assisting me, you know, during this case, and, you know, we know that if it were to come up, they could say something to the effect that we know that the data shows that having, you know, trainees helping us in cases and participating in cases doesn't compromise the overall, you know, outcome or success of the surgeries, and we're comfortable with that. So that would be, I think, something that physicians can count on and can utilize in their discussions with patients. But then, by the same token, I think that having the trainee involved from the beginning, before the case even starts, I think that actually makes the post-op complication conversation easier in a way, because it's not someone new that is coming up in the conversation, and you're not having to say, oh, you know, there was this complication that occurred, and, you know, this other person was helping me during the surgery, and we didn't talk about it before the case or something like that, you know. So I think if you're open with the patient, and that's why I think that, you know, it's nice to have in training programs a setup where the trainee is actually involved before the surgery with the patient in some way, at least at a pre-op visit, so that there's face time there. And so it's not a new person who shows up when there's a problem. And that, I think, you know, we've been very deliberate about trying to be completely open about that. And then, and in the same way, being very forthright with patients, as soon as we're in the PACU, you know, if there was a complication, we disclose that. And we actually, you know, it empowers the patient to sort of be part of the process and to know what's going on. And we've actually factored that in at a department-wide level. In our department, we have a weekly microsurgery conference where we actually talk about all the complications that everyone had in each subspecialty. And you know, the question is frequently posed, you know, how did you guys handle that with the patient? And you know, the answer is always, because this is what the culture that we have, the answer is always, you know, we talked about it in the PACU. Let the patient know, you know, this is why you're having to be face down now. We weren't expecting you to have a gas bubble, you know, whatever it was. And so, you know, knock on wood, it's been a good way to do things, because you know, we're just open about it, and the patient, nothing is, there's no effort to hide anything from anyone. And I think that's really where we're able to make it work.
You know, last thing I want to ask you before we go, and not to bite off more than we can chew, but you do uveitis in addition to your retina and your teaching roles. You were one of the participants in the MUST trial, which has gone on for many years and was released the most recent results in the past year. What are kind of your big takeaways from being not only seeing the results in the MUST trial, but kind of being involved in enrolling patients and doing these, you know, retiserts or keeping patients on oral steroids in your day-to-day practice? I mean, how does that result and kind of the experience influence what you recommend for patients?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, it's been really great to have access to, you know, surgical implantable steroid delivery over the past decade. And the MUST trial has been, you know, very, very important in giving us kind of insight into how to use that. And you know, one of the things that, so the MUST trial basically in the formal 2-year data outcomes now, you know, 8 years ago from the study, basically showed similar visual outcomes between patients being treated with Retisert in both eyes versus patients getting systemic therapy. Although actually the implant patients had, you know, a lower amount of residual active uveitis at the end of the study. And I think they had a little bit of a better quality of life indicator as well. But what was found, and this was also kind of discussed in the paper that came out last year on the 7-year data, which was that over the course of time, the systemic therapy patients actually did a little better in terms of vision and the, you know, some of the other indicators. And I think that what the authors point out, which we actually observed in real life as well, is that patients who get the implant, the problem is that if they're not actively kind of exchanged out in anticipation of the drug running out, then the patients will tend to have a relapse, and then they'll actually lose vision from those relapses. And that seems to be what happened in the case of you know, the patients that were followed over the longer term. And so that's, I think, why the implant group hasn't done as well as the systemic management patients did. On the other hand, you know, we actually have, within our own kind of practice here, working together with the uveitis specialists at the Proctor Foundation at UCSF, we actually take an approach where we proactively will change out patients' retiserts before they are running out. And so, you know, that really allows us to avoid the relapses. And I think that is, you know, and we've had very good outcomes as a result of that. But, you know, that requires really a very proactive, you know, plan and management of patients, and also the patient has to kind of be engaged in the process, and that's the key to success. But I think that it's been a good introduction to us, this Retisert experience, just, you know, in terms of sort of sustained drug delivery, and I think we're moving in a direction of sustained delivery of anti-VEGFs and other drugs, and I think that it's gotten, you know, it's gotten us some good experience in understanding what the limitations and benefits are. And I think the short version, I think, is that local treatment is really effective, but it requires you to be very actively engaged in kind of managing it and watching for, you know, what is the duration of drug delivery, and how do you transition someone to the next device so that they have continued treatment.
Well, that's really well put. Well, Dr. Stewart, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us today and talking a little bit about not only your research, but also your experience. And Dan Chow is a friend and also a friend of the program. I've always spoke very highly about working with you and the things he learned. So it's great to talk to you one-on-one and learn from your experience as well.
Yeah, thanks. It was a real pleasure to talk to you.
Take care.
All right, bye-bye.
As always, you can find this episode and all 159 prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. We have a blog on our website as well, where we have weekly reflections on the latest episodes. How do you hear about these episodes? If you want to hear about them, you can either subscribe on the website to a mailing list, so you'll get email updates as the episodes come out. Alternatively, you can subscribe on your smartphone in the Apple Podcasts or Google Play, Android Store. You can like our Facebook page, you can find us on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and to contact us, click on the Contact Us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We love feedback. It gives us ideas on what we can do better, things we can already continue to do, and we also appreciate people who have left reviews in the Apple Store and Android Store. Please continue to leave those positive comments. They're very, very helpful. Many thanks to Dr. Jay Stewart for joining me. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Mike Benacasa, Angela Chang for producing a great episode. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis. I know I say this every episode, but please, again, thank you, providers, the patient care you deliver, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here each week so we can all learn and benefit together. This is Jay Schreather, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.